Hello and welcome to the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24 with me, Robert Bound, and Tom Edwards.
On today's show, we'll speak to Alice Black, co-director of London's Design Museum, about what makes for good design in 2018.
We'll also be welcoming back show favourite Travis Elborough. His new book tells the story of the last century from the perspective of some of its most memorable diarists.
And we'll be learning how to get 2018 off to a healthy start, business-wise, with networking expert Julia Hobsbawm. She'll be discussing why a little bit of digital detox might do us all some good.
That's all coming up, plus Henry Rees-Sheridan will be here with next week's news, and we'll enjoy some great music too, right here, of course, on The Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. So normal services resumed in the Monocle 24 running order, Tom. Happy New Year. It's pretty late to be wishing you it, but a radio Happy New Year to you.
Thank you, Rob. And I must say, I'm finding it quite hard to get back into the regular pace of things.
Yeah.
Slow start, I feel, to January. It's a little grey. It's a bit miserable, but we have some audio sunshine to spread to our global listeners.
That's a beautiful thing to impart to them. This week in London, it's felt kind of like it's been raining up from the pavement,
yeah.
which is a pretty gross thing to have. So why not spend some quality time here in Studio One with us? And we should extend that invitation to our listeners. We've got some pretty good people lined up, as discussed in the intro there.
Exactly. I'm very excited. I'm a bit of a Luddite, so I'm particularly interested to hear from Julia Hobsbawm about sort of digital detoxing, switching off, Rob, literally and metaphorically.
I'm pretty good at that. What about over the holidays? Are you on your phone? Are you caring about stuff like that? Or are you kind of getting 9 hours of sleep?
I kept a weather eye. Yeah. I'm trying to get to sleep around about 9 p.m. at the moment. It's working for me. Can't you see? Look at this face.
I saw the pipe and slippers parked outside the studio door here, and I wondered to whom they belonged.
Oh, they're mine.
Anyway, we said that we've got some fantastic bookings lined up on this show, but of course there is one bad apple in every show. Henry Rees-Sheridan, welcome back in 2018. Henry, oh Henry, blow the way you jump and rock. All right. Henry, oh Henry, blow the way you take this hop. But how am I doing now? Everything is all
right. Hi Rob, how's it going?
Very well, thank you.
Hi Tom.
You?
So, between the 14th and the 17th of January, the Israeli Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, is going to visit India. India and Israel have a quite interesting and fairly unexpected, I would say, at least to my mind, a special relationship.
Do they?
Yeah, they do. So they're working towards a trade agreement at the moment, but there's also an extremely strong arms trade between the two countries, mainly India purchasing drones and other arms made by Israel. In 2009, now I know this is a bit of a while back now, but there was a remarkable poll conducted in 2009 from an Israeli institute, I think, surveying sympathy with Israel around the world. The number one country was India. 58% of Indians express sympathy with Israel, compared to 56% of Americans.
Wow, I'm really surprised by that. I was really surprised
by that, yeah. You know, I'm
I wonder
sure
where culturally, there's one thing about trade and arms and all this kind of stuff, but there is obviously some cultural understanding, which I'm quite surprised about.
Well, somebody,
I've forgotten who now, but
someone who I was talking to upstairs, when I was regaling them with these factoids. Factlets, sorry, Tom doesn't
factoids,
like me misusing
Steve
factoids.
Right in the afternoon.
Indeed. And they pointed out that actually the two countries, I think, were formed, if not in the same decade, then within a decade of each other. Could there be some kind of sympathy through that? I don't know. Maybe that's stretching it a little bit. But it's one explanation. It's intriguing, though. Let's move on, though, to a more serious topic. On the 15th of January...
More serious than that?
The Pogues' Shane McGowan...
Yes, this is better.
...is going to have his 60th, and I know you're thinking, is it only his 60th birthday concert in Dublin? Now, I think that that's somewhat controversial because he was born in Kent. Some people,
was he?
Yeah, he was. He was born in Pembury in 1957.
I can hear the sound somewhere in the background of Mr. McGowan ripping up your all expenses paid backstage pass to his, what can only be described as probably a fairly decent bash.
Tearing through the laminate. Yes,
I was going to say, how long is it going to go on for, his 60th birthday?
I don't actually know any more details.
Until he's 70.
Yeah.
What
until he isn't 70.
Yeah.
What are your views on McGowan?
Well, I love the Pogues. Rum, Sodomy and the Lash is one of my favourite albums. It's amazing. He's a man who hides a considerable talent under a kind of like, sort of Falstaffian bushel, I would have said. And I think he's a good musician, a good singer.
Tom, I know what you're going to come out with now, because one of my favourite pieces of music trivia actually relates to a Pogue song. You told me it. Do you know what I'm talking
about? Remind me.
It was to do with the, I've forgotten, the Christmas song that they wrote.
Fairy Tale of
New York. Do you remember? You told me this. It's about the boys of the NYPD choir.
Oh, the boys from the NYPD choir. There is no NYPD choir.
Is there not?
Apparently, I mean, now write in if I've got that wrong. But as I understand it, that's a falsehood.
And never has been.
4 months for internet? We've got a year.
I mean, what, us?
For next Christmas?
Us personally.
Yeah.
Rob, we aren't actually members of the New York Police Department.
No, but you know, you can get outfits. Style it out.
Style it out.
Yeah.
Okay.
Let's do it.
I've got a T-shirt with NYPD on it.
On the 16th of January, handbrake tone change there, there's going to be a new $1 billion US embassy opening in London.
Now, relocation. Can I tell you my favourite fact about the new embassy?
Hit me.
It's the first building in, I think, getting on for 1,000 years to open in London with a moat.
Has it got a moat?
Yeah.
That's amazing.
That's good, isn't it?
A full moat.
Full. Obviously, it's accessible. There's a bridge or a drawbridge or something, portcullis, I don't know.
You can't get,
it doesn't go all the way around.
Are there arrows?
You have to swim in.
They don't still call it a moat,
I think
surely.
It's a moat. It's
is
a big
moat.
It's a moat. It's a thing full of water for security.
Yeah. Really?
Yeah.
A 12-storey glass cube, I'm describing the building now, overlooking the River Thames, set in Nine Elms. Have you been to the current US embassy in Grosvenor Square?
I've not been inside it now.
Fairly imposing.
Yeah.
Exactly, relatively just around the corner from us. Yeah.
Down in Mayfair.
Indeed.
If you have to go in on certain business, passport, visa-related business, you have to leave all your effects, including any telecoms devices, elsewhere.
Yeah.
So you have to put them in a locker or something adjacent. And go in.
Well, outside of the actual physical embassy?
Yes, yes.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, they surely provide facilities for...
I don't know. No. You can't even take the stuff in. I don't know whether they'll transfer that policy to the new bemoated building, but who knows?
I guess so. And obviously the news this week was that Donald Trump is not going to visit for the opening of this new embassy, right? And he said, well, you know, it's a bad real estate decision. I think if he knows about one thing, it's probably property. He knows quite a bit about it, and I think he's for once got a point on this, right?
Well, the only problem is that he suggested that it was sold, or the sale of the old property in Mayfair was done by the Obama administration. It wasn't. It was actually put in train by the Bush administration.
Right. Yeah, it's been a long time coming, this.
And the property actually is in the portfolio of the Duke of Westminster. So they didn't own it anyway, outright.
What will happen to the old embassy?
It's been turned into a hotel.
Seriously?
As I understand it, isn't that right?
I don't know, actually.
Yeah, I think it's been...
The highest security hotel in London.
Well, they're going to take all the old bollards away, aren't they? Or maybe they'll leave them.
It'll probably be embassy-themed, won't it? Or something similarly naff. Anyway.
It's good stuff. Is that the end of the news roundup?
Don't say it like you're expecting
No, I'm not expecting more. I thought it was a really thoroughly interesting one. American Embassy, Shane McGowan's birthday. Israel and India.
Nearly
the unlikely friendship.
Amazing. Thanks, Rob.
Very interesting.
Thank you very much, Tom.
Later this month, London's Design Museum will be announcing the winner of the Beazley Designs of the Year Award. The annual prize follows the exhibition of the same name that's been showing over the past few weeks at the museum.
The Beazley Designs of the Year exhibition collects work from over 60 projects that are pushing design forward, be it graphics, architecture, product design, or something more unusual. Standouts this year include the original pussy hat used by protesters expressing solidarity against President Donald Trump's sexist remarks, and the refugee national flag, which was created to represent stateless athletes at the 2016 Rio Olympics.
Alice Black is co-director of the Design Museum, and she joins us now to discuss the outlook for design in 2018. Welcome to the Monocle Weekly, Alice. Good to have you with us. Let's just pick up on a couple of the things that Rob mentioned there. The pussy hat, the refugee nation flag. It's interesting. These are things that are very much born out of activism. And this is something which is front and centre if we look at the news media at the moment. How much is that something that's really shaped certainly the last 12 to 18 months? And how front and centre is that amongst the works that are on display?
Absolutely front and centre, because in fact Designs of the Year is an exhibition that we run annually at the Design Museum. So we look at the most innovative projects over the last 12 months in different categories, and you've mentioned a few of them, Rob.
I ticked them off. I teed them up for you to hit them down the middle. That's my job here. It's good.
So yes, there's also fashion and digital and transport. But we get nominations from peers in the industry. So to be included in Designs of the Year, you have to be nominated by your peers, by people in the design world, architecture. And out of these nominations, then we see the topics and the key sections of the exhibition emerge. And activism is actually one of them. There's a few others. There's innovations as well. And this is really front and center. We've seen things like the refugee crisis loom large over the projects that have been put forward in Designs of the Year this year, but also last year, because last year's winner was the Better Shelter project, which was done in partnership with the IKEA Foundation to look at building shelters that could be flat pack and also built very quickly in refugee camps. And it was commissioned by the UNCHR. What's amazing about Designs of the Year is that it's very topical. It's about now, because we look at the last 12 months, and so it responds to current issues. And what I love about this exhibition is its optimism, because frankly, on a cold January day, we'd much rather be at home and huddle on the sofa with a hot cup of tea. But the news that surrounds us is deeply depressing. You come to the Design Museum, look at Beazley Designs of the Year, and you realize that actually there are designers out there who are looking to create a better world. And it's happening right here, right now. They're still busy doing it. The refugee nation flag, for me, is one of the key projects there, because first of all, it's very visual. So it's very much of today's age, where we're living increasingly in a visual world. This young refugee experienced the trauma of crossing Mediterranean waters, arriving, and what she saw were piles of life jackets, this very bright orange. And she thought, how can I get back into real life, and how can I do something to reintegrate refugees who have no countries anymore, but still want to be part of our lives? And so she recreated this bright orange refugee flag. And I think that's, you know, she's a young person, and it's not feeling sorry, much as you could feel incredibly sorry for being in this situation, but it's trying to have agency and change the world and do something positive out of it. So activism, front and center, the Design Museum.
I wanted to ask you about whether all these pieces of design, they're artifacts, sure, but are they all on purpose? Are there any accidental pieces of design? I'm reminded of a really good show a couple of years ago at the V&A called Disobedient Objects. A lot of it was kind of folk art, and some of it was also, are all these things have been produced to address a problem and also tell you something about the state of the world we live in right now? Or are some of them kind of things that you and the judges and the peers of the designers have picked out as something that is telling about the world but hasn't necessarily been designed to fulfil a purpose, I wonder?
Well, I would say by and large, Designs of the Year are all real projects. Mm. They are either prototype or they exist. However, there are some elements of speculative design in there. And so as you coined it, accidental design. Mm. But in that provocation, it's telling us something about the world we live in. So, for example, in this year's Designs of the Year, there is a project around creating a new type of beer aimed at the refugees, again, in Germany. So it's not a real project. However, what it says is, think about it, designers and manufacturers and creators of beer product. You've got huge new audiences that are arriving in these markets. They are consumers as well. So you might think in very segmented and marketed-driven way about the product that you create and the market that you sell for, but actually these markets are changing and are changing hugely. So I think
there's something of the hunch. There's a witty thing. It's almost like a design project. It's like a student design project. Just go off and think of a solution to this problem.
Yes, and that's what design is. You know, we're a museum of design. Design starts from the user and a market and realizing that there is an issue, that there is an opportunity, actually. So what are we going to create to meet that market? But design has always had this streak about being provocative and also about imagining a different kind of world. When Steve Jobs and Jonathan Ive create the iPhone, the iPods and all the iThing, they create a market that didn't exist. We didn't know we needed one of those before, but boy, do we need them.
That's a way of looking at it, Alice.
Yes. So there is that sort of innovation. And yeah. Again, there is that in Beazley Designs of the Year, innovative product. But there is also thinking outside of the box.
Well, to that point, I just wonder, Alice, you probably may be biased on this, given your role. Would you trust designers to design humanity's way out of some of the biggest problems we face? Because we've got a pretty uninspiring bunch of politicians wherever you look in the world, and yet the problems we face as a human collective seem more profound than ever. Are we better placed backing designers to design our way out of trouble? They're better at real solutions, aren't they, than the political classes?
Are you going to trust politicians to design anything? I don't know.
To politic their way out of trouble.
But I would say what's amazing about design is that it pulls in different disciplines. Of course, you have designers at the center of it who are the active ingredients, but they pull in engineers, they pull in technology, they pull in marketeers, because it's the alliance of all of these skills and new technologies emerging that create the right products. So I think it's not just the designers, but absolutely the designers play a key role. I think it's how we decide what priorities, how we decide to see what's important today. We live in very uncertain times, and I think our role is to provoke the debate, is to say, is it the environment? Is it housing? How do we protest? Because you look at the industrial strategy that the government has produced, and it's great to see that the creative industries have been earmarked as one important sector that will get a sector deal, but maybe it lacks a little bit of ambition. So what we're here to do is to say, be more ambitious about the environment, about aging. It's interesting, one of the important pillars of that industrial strategy is around creating new ways for people to live older better, to address the aging population, because today in Britain there are more pensioners than there are teenagers already. But at the Design Museum last year we had an exhibition on that already. So wishful thinking that the Design Museum's exhibition informed that strategy. You know, maybe, who knows? But this is really our mission, to provoke these ideas, and hopefully they will be grasped by politicians to, you know, drive the progress.
And just to ask a little bit about the accessibility of Designs of the Year, is this an easy one to kind of sell? Because you're presenting designs that, as we've alluded to, perhaps present solutions to the problems of the world, or very particular tiny solutions that you might not have wondered, but they're such a witty and intelligent and attractive piece of design that they make it into the show. When people are coming to look at an exhibition like this, are they almost looking at themselves in the mirror, do you think, in terms of design? Do you think that people are finding familiarity in the problems that these designers are solving? I mean, I wonder how explicit your curatorial notes have to be for something like this. What the wall text is like when you're basically saying, here is the world, here are some solutions to it. Some are practical, some are witty. Go figure. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. What's amazing is there is such a varied audience for Designs of the Year. I was in the exhibition yesterday and there was a big group of young people, early 20s, I would say, and they were just deep, you know, enthralled into looking at these objects. Largely, they tell their own stories. What our job is to pull together those themes and ask those sort of big contextual questions. What does it say about us? But anyone can find something for themselves in Designs of the Year. I remember last year there was an amazing little app which was for people riding bicycles as they ride through the cities. If you have to check your city mapper on your phone, well, you're going to come to some trouble if you're doing that as you're riding your bike. But it's something that plugs in onto your bike, so it indicates the direction. So we know we've got a big community of cyclists in London, and there was certainly, you know, so they'll find themselves here. But you find also an older generation in Designs of the Year. And what's great is it's 10 years now. It's coming back every year at the same time. So our audience is getting used to it and really comes back to for that stimulation. There was another amazing project by two young women who corresponded and created a statistics book about a variety of things that they encountered in their lives, like how many hugs they got in that week, or, you know, how many times they went out to eat. And they made statistics out of that, and they send postcards to each other, and it's a very graphic project, and then they put it together as a book.
Wow.
Come on.
That's so good.
Know, how amazing. You couldn't make, you know, invent those things. And this is people around us. So there's such a variety. And today we've got a 3D printed bus. There is also the recreation of the Maison de Verre in virtual reality. You can see it in the exhibition. So that variety is almost intoxicating.
Intoxicating, and presumably pretty hard to choose between. But I'm right in saying later this month, the prize nevertheless will be awarded. How on earth do you and your colleagues decide, of all of these pieces of individual or collective brilliance, what is at the very top of the tree? An invidious task, perhaps.
So I wouldn't want to have to do that job. And luckily, I don't. We actually bring together a panel. So judges, where the design museum, the directors, curators are not part of that panel. Our job is to pull the long list together.
And passing the buck a little bit, the tricky challenge.
Well, we make the first cut.
Exactly. You've done the hard work.
The panel this year was chaired by David Rowan of Wired Magazine, and we had Margaret Calvert, Amanda Levitt, Michael Chow, Jerry McGovern from Jaguar Land Rover. So amazing designers, and they have the incredibly tough job to select category winners for each of the six categories, and then out of those six winners, the overall winners. So we give them criteria, because there's criteria for the selection of the projects and agents of change, things that projects that are really about to bring change, that bring design practice forward, and they have to weigh these different projects. I'd say usually selecting the category winners is relatively straightforward. When it gets really sticky is the overall winner. Because how do you judge a piece of architecture versus, you know, graphic design? But that's the challenge about Designs of the Year. It's the one that's going to have most impact in the long term. And what's amazing is it's not hindsight, it's foresight. Mm. So chances are you may get it wrong. In the year when the iPhone was designed, we didn't award the prize to the iPhone. We selected another project, which was by Yves Béard, One Laptop Per Child, to try and bring laptops to the developing countries. Great project, but actually developing countries leapfrogged laptops, went on to mobile, and, you know, we couldn't have known ahead of time. But, you know, that says something about the world at a certain point of time. We don't purport to say that we get it right all the time, but the thinking is what matters.
It's fascinating stuff. Until when is the exhibition running?
So the exhibition runs until the 19th of February, and the awards will be announced at a ceremony in the Design Museum on the 25th of January.
Alice Black from the Design Museum, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you so much.
Time for some new music now. This is from Pamplona in Spain. It's Melenas with Cartel de Neon. We'll be right back.
Melenas from Spain with Cartel de Neon here on the Monocle Weekly with me, Tom Edwards, and Robert Bound.
Travis Elborough has appeared on this show discussing topics as diverse as the history of parks to how to become a writer. His latest book looks at the history of the 20th century from the intrinsically personal perspective of diary entries.
Our 20th century, as told in diaries, journals and letters, looks at the passing of time through diary entries and correspondence from both public figures and some less storied characters. And Travis joins us once again to talk about it. Welcome back to the Monocle Weekly, Travis.
A pleasure.
Good to have you with us. There is something enduringly attractive about the diary and reading people's personal correspondence, not in a horrible voyeuristic way, although that is also quite compelling. But again, I think we sort of touched on this before with some of these kind of compilations you've worked on. Where do you start when your source material is just in the millions or billions of pages? How do you even begin to work out what's going to be in it?
The premise of the book itself is roughly the 20th century. So it begins in 1900 and ends in the millennium. So that's one scope. The other window we had was that it was going to be Britain. Although world events are reflected through the diaries and so on, but it would be home front, say, stuff from either the wars rather than trench or in the field diary. So that you set yourself certain ranges of parameters. And then for a book like this particularly, we kind of made a big list of key events in the 20th century and sort of thought we would want to have covered or at least mentioned. And then a lot of it's just chance and digging around in archives and reading, you know, reams and reams of diaries, some published, some not. I even, you know, put out requests on social media for people, did they have any diaries and so on. So I got some that way as well. And then some of them come via the famous, you know, mass observation project, which began in the 1930s and was particularly strong during the Second World War, where people like this woman called Gladys Langford, who was a teacher in Highbury, who kept a diary from the 30s and sort of into the early 50s, and contributed to the mass observation project. And her diaries are very good, actually, and very sort of frank about sex. She didn't marry, she was a spinster, but she had a lover, and she was sort of quite left-wing. So she wrote about you know, the causes and moods of the times that were happening. And some of hers are actually very, very funny and very, very witty as well. But what I'm looking for really is voices, that idea of being addressed from the past in a way that seems sometimes actually disarmingly contemporary. I mean, we're just approaching the anniversary of votes for women, or certain votes for women at this point. And a couple of my diarists, there's two women called Ruth Slate and Eva Slawson who were involved in suffragette causes. And Ruth Slate has this appalling boyfriend called Wall or Wally, who keeps giving her kind of anti-suffragette literature. Some of their diaries are very, I mean, they're discussing things which are quite particular to the early quarter of the 20th century. Fad diets of that time, sort of, you know, whether someone should be a vegetarian or, you know, in that kind of quite socialist way, you know, the sort of cranks and that sort of way. But, you know, again, they're surprisingly, the voices themselves are actually surprisingly contemporary. And their concerns, you know, their concerns about, as women, being taken seriously and whether this relationship is working out. I mean, there's not a huge amount of about sex per se in their diaries. And again, I think that's another thing about how over time some of those things change in what. There's a strange thing about diaries, isn't there, in a way, that obviously an element of they're intensely private. Some diarists, of course, are writing for posterity and publication.
I wonder if you noticed a sense of performance in the diarist that knew that he or she might be of note.
I think that's definitely the case. And there's actually a couple of examples where I didn't choose a particular diary. So Alan Clark, for example, the politician, I've used a couple of very good diaries in there. But he has a sort of first-hand account of Margaret Thatcher's resignation, which in the end I decided not to use, even though he was on hand witnessing that stuff. He was clearly writing for posterity. So his account of that particular event, the resignation of Thatcher, presents himself as very central to the action. Whereas in the end, the entry I went to was actually from, he's now an academic, but it was his teenage diaries. And he's describing just hearing the news on the street and the shock that's going around. And that, it's one of those slight biases in a way, that's sort of my memory of the kind of almost, we can't really believe this has happened element.
Yeah, yeah. Everyone at a bar, everyone in a pub would be talking about the same thing that day, that week. Right? So there's a social history element. Definitely. Can I ask you about that, Travis? This reads as its diary entries, but it also has that swing of social history
about it,
like some of the great books which are put together simply in quote marks of different people, sort of different people kind of following a story through. Did you kind of want to give it that swing and a bit of a spot the difference between the great and the good and the ordinary men and women in the street? And, you know, you're almost tempted to not put an appropriation to them so that you can just sort of spot the way that they use the language.
Yeah, I mean, I think sometimes it's important who has said this because it comes from a particular position. So I think identification in that way. But certainly there's a book called Pandemonium, which is put together by Humphrey Jennings, the great documentary filmmaker and actually a founding figure of the mass observation, which is a portrait of the Industrial Revolution from period documents. And so on. That was something of a role model when I was trying to put the book together. I think the idea was to have bottom-up and top-down, because it's the 20th century. One of the other things that changes is communication and technology. So, for example, when the First World War breaks out, everyone's hanging around waiting for the newspapers to be printed and delivered so they can get the latest news. By the time the Second World War comes around, you've got the BBC and you've got the wireless. So there's an entry by, there's a theatre critic who kept series of journals which were published in the 30s and into the 40s called James Agot. And he describes them all tuning in and hearing the Neville Chamberlain announcement, him saying, you know, with that intensely English accent. So that idea that the news comes in that form. And then if we go right to the end of the book, we do have Princess Diana's death, and all of my correspondents, all of my diarists, receive that information through effectively analogue technology. They hear about it, either someone rings them up, or they hear it on the radio, or on the television news. The internet does exist, but no one is getting that news via Twitter or any other kind of social media platform. And to think that that's 20 years ago, I suppose the weird thing is in a way that actually the stuff from the 80s and 90s seems eminently recent, suddenly becomes almost as ancient and odder and stranger maybe than some of the earlier 20th century stuff where you're expecting it to be all a bit horse-drawn and a bit steam-powered. So you kind of make allowances for that. But then to realise, one of the diarists I've actually used in the two previous diary anthologies as well, he's the longest standing or continuous online blogger / diarist, a man called Dickon Edwards, who was a kind of minor pop musician and is now also in academia these days. You know, he has things about, you know, the idea of the death of the music industry because of the internet. But in his diary entry, he's saying, you know, well, I'm fine. I order all my CDs online. You know, the predictions are still... And there's a discussion about... He discussed the etiquette of email, you know, and round-robin emails and things, which, of course, you know, don't really exist anymore, or certainly that conversation.
You're charting this extraordinary technological and communications change of the 20th century. Have you learned anything about the 21st century? Because it's striking, you know, you were talking with Rob about whether stuff was designed to be shared or if it was your true innermost thoughts that were only as your own record.
Yep.
These days, with social media, of course, I guess probably since the turn of the millennium, that's all about sharing or oversharing, and it's very democratic, yes, but maybe there's too much white noise. With all of that going on, will the art of diary keeping be lost? Do you get a sense of that? Because everybody shares their innermost thoughts as they're having the thoughts.
Well, that's the thing, isn't it? Historically, the thing about diaries were that you would be often writing them at night. There would be your, you know, accrued reflections upon what had happened. When I sent my "Please, do you have any diaries?" email around to people, responded saying, oh yes, I used to keep a live journal diary. But that tended to be in the early 2000s when blogging was quite the thing. I suppose what the shift is that the instantaneous representation of your thoughts via Twitter and so on and in this condensed form. The other bigger change, I think, possibly, is also things like Instagram and photo blogging. So in some of the diaries I have here, one of the things I'm quite fascinating is trends in food, for example. So, you know, newfangled things, whether it's, you know, the sort of Happy Eater or these fast food joints, there's reactions to those in the 50s and 60s. Tony Benn goes to a Wimpy, you know, for example. And Michael Palin goes to one of the first McDonald's in England, in Kentish Town, and is struck by how the bags for the food in his reflections look like the sick bags you get on airplanes. And it's that kind of stuff. There's another, Rowena McDonald writes about, you know, having this exciting new dish, guacamole. And of course, now, though, when you have an exciting new dish, you know, avocado on toast, to continue with a theme, you might just take a photograph of it and post it. So whether or not the diary becomes much more a pictogrammatic form, whether someone doing something for the 21st century, it would have to almost be an anthology of film clips or pictures. I think that's the really different thing, I think, which is changing. And again, as you say, that shift from the private and personal to the public. Mm. Interestingly, I mean, there's a whole argument about diaries coming out of the sort of Reformation and Protestantism, i.e. the whole thing about diaries are that you hold yourself accountable to God, and therefore there's a kind of element that the diary is a form of reckoning spiritually as much as anything else. But prior to that, in a way, people who did write were often writing, whether they be monks or whatever, were writing for public record rather than for personal reflection. So it might be in a way that we're, in a strange kind of way, the very public nature of our current discourse and how we display stuff is that might be oddly closer to the pre-diary age. That's just one of those curious
only,
circles.
Only time, though. Literally, only time will tell.
Exactly. Yeah.
And just before we go, just a quickie, Travis. You mentioned, I like the idea of your teacher from Islington, who's a single woman, talking about her sex life and many other things. When you wrote down your big list of things that happened in the 20th century, tried to find diary entries to support those things or describe those things, did you, in reading through diaries, people that weren't well known, like teachers from Highbury, for example, did themes like sex or like things that had been undocumented publicly and officially, did they seep out and make a chapter, I wonder?
This is an element of retrospectiving as well. I mean, it's called our history, but of course, in a way, it's my history because I've put it together and it has my biases as much as the diarists themselves have a bias. I mean, the thing about diaries as well is they have no compulsion to tell the truth. You can't necessarily trust them entirely, but it is where we go for unblemished thoughts. I think what does happen, or when you're reading stuff and you're struck by it, is, for example, that there's a wartime diarist called Jack Overhill who lived in Cambridge. Again, his little private diary is not anyone that anyone would have heard of. And in 1940, which is a very good illustration of that, he writes quite a lot about, you know, Churchill's lost cause, I'm sure we'll have to make an accord, and things like that. So you get these kind of, nuanced bits about history. I mean, even right at the beginning, for example, Arnold Bennett, the novelist, writes about the death of Queen Victoria. And, you know, we think of it, obviously, must have been an incredibly solemn occasion, this monarch which had been on the throne for ages. Actually, he says, no, the people were not, on the whole, deeply moved, whatever journalists may say, but rather serene and cheerful. And then he goes off and has lunch and says, you know, all very agreeable and merry. I suppose what I'm trying to say is, of course, there are lots of odd things. I mean, things like jokes, for example. Virginia Ironside records all the jokes about Robert Maxwell's death. This woman called Mrs. Helen Duddeny writes about a rumour at the time that Mrs. Simpson was a Russian spy. These little details of history which perhaps get lost, I think those are the things that I really love about putting a book like this together.
Travis Elbra, thank you as ever. The book is Our History of the 20th Century, as told in diaries, journals and letters. And it's out now. Thank you very much
indeed. Thank you.
Staying connected is part of the modern workplace. Technology allows us to now be in the loop pretty much 24/7. And that might be good for business, but is it a healthy way to live a life?
Julia Hobsbawm is a speaker on social health and connectedness and honorary visiting professor at London's Cass Business School. And her recent book, Fully Connected, Surviving and Thriving in an Age of Overload, looks at how technology is affecting everyday productivity and much more besides. She'll soon be launching a podcast on the topic as well, The Human and the Machine.
And she joins us now to tell us how to get 2018 off to the best possible start, amongst other facets of this. So welcome to the Monocle Weekly.
Hello.
Julia, let me ask you, I guess the little Luddite who stands on my shoulder in perpetuity would say to me, well, look, the only way to truly overcome overload is to hit the off button altogether. Presumably, as a starting point, that's a step much too far.
No, I mean, I practice a sort of secular Shabbat, a techno Shabbat every week. I think it's actually incredibly necessary. There is an ongoing tension now between the way we humans are expected to outsource a lot of what we do to machines and to operate as if we are machines. And, you know, simple neuroscience, simple common sense says we simply can't function always on all the time. And I think part of the problem, of course, is that the so-called triple revolution of the internet, social and mobile means we are literally permanently connected all of the time, 24/7. We need to impose our own health rules in much the same way we've learnt to around our physical and our mental health. For me, the algorithm-led era of infobesity is just as serious as as sugar. You know,
I like infobesity. So you also really like, just to go back to your first answer, a techno Shabbat. That
yes, you don't
great.
Even have to be Jewish.
It's no, I like that.
But
very
it helps.
I just wanted to ask you, we sit up at the beginning and we were talking about that maybe this interconnectedness and constant connectedness is very good for your work life and maybe not so good for your private life, as we might put it. But is it that good for your work life? When you have a sort of constant flow of emails, you constantly feel like, I feel like a lot of people listening to this programme might feel that they've got jobs these days which they can never finish. You know, you go home at the end of each day, but the kind of job never stops. Is that something that was in your mind while you were writing this, or is that a concern that permeates your book, Julia?
Yes, I'm worried really about two things. One is I think that there's a little bit too much technology Kool-Aid being drunk around the place. Mm. I mean, I'm as addicted as anybody else to social media and to technology, and there's an app for that. And yet and but, the human being and the way we operate has got to remain central, unless you're sort of, you know, using a robot to do microscopic surgery or something. And therefore, when you have a working environment, which often is dominated by a computer-led, speed-led, scale-led environment of the machine, that means we're all stressed and it means we're unproductive. Productivity remains the largest challenge for developed economies. Sometimes it goes up a teeny weeny bit and then it falls back down. So the machine-assisted age isn't necessarily moving the needle on productivity. So that's the first thing. And the second thing is that we know a lot more from neuroscience about simply the way human beings like to work, and actually we can't multitask as much as we think we can, and constant interruption and a demand for our attention fragments it. There was an interesting piece of Australian research that showed an average office worker might have 80 interruptions a day from email. That switching in between tasks isn't really very, to coin my phrase, healthy. It's not socially healthy. So lots of what we're dealing with is good and productive, and I would not want to go to an isolated workplace. But we do need to take seriously the way that we're constructing what success looks like at work. We are, a lot of us, overloaded. Lots of us feel that we can never switch off. Mind you, in our personal lives as well, it becomes more of a problem with regard to social media. People are more on Facebook up to 50 minutes a day, the active Facebook user, than they are face to face. Well, that's just plain wrong, in my view. Yeah.
And probably rather antisocial.
You see
media.
The tops of a lot exactly. of people's heads more than you see their faces. These
yeah.
days, right? Yeah.
Or the whole kind of narcissism thing, the whole inferiority complex thing, all the stuff we also know and articulate. So I think we need a new language, actually. I particularly think we need it at work because most of us spend at least 10,000 days of our lives working. And
that's a yeah. sobering number, isn't it, Rob?
Yeah.
Oh,
and
Julia.
Sorry to give you the bad news. But the good news is there's lots and lots of things we can do about it. And my starting point actually for the book was that 70 years ago this year, both the National Health Service in the UK, but the World Health Organization was created. And the definition of health, which hasn't changed for 70 years, has a teeny weeny bit in the middle that refers to social well-being. Mm. But of course, social well-being now is very different to what it meant in a pre-computer era. So I'd like to say, let's take as a given, we're perma-connected to devices, to information, to electronic-led worlds, and that sort of good, but we need to know how to manage it. Just like we need a literacy and a skill and a practice and a set of behaviours around the way we look at our diet and our exercise. So it doesn't have to be overcomplicated, but at the moment, what we are doing is living in the sort of technology 2.1 love-in, which is we don't need to do anything. And no. I think we do. I think we need to do quite a lot.
You don't think it is a phase of being infatuated with this, the newness of it, and eventually in 10 years, in a decade, it settles down. People that like new technology, people that enjoy this new ability to be interacting with people in a different way, on different platforms at different times of day, maybe constantly, you don't feel that it might naturally reach a level of, you might say, normal humanity.
Well, I do. I think we are already definitely coming out of that first love-in era, and a lot of discussions, and you know, my book is being published because there's an appetite for these kind of discussions and so on. But I think that change happens when culture changes, and culture changes when we think and talk quite deeply and consistently around what's not right as well as what could go right. And I think that we are still slightly believing the narrative that technology allows us to do more. And we can't actually change the number of hours in a day. Not even Elon Musk can do that. You know, there's 168 hours in the week. That's a hard stop. A third of those hours we need to sleep. So I'd quite like to locate the way we talk about productivity and time and technology in quite hard physiological terms, which is what are the limits of the human rather than what's the limitlessness of the machine. I don't know if you agree with that.
Absolutely. Otherwise, we're all living in a Ballard nightmare, aren't we?
Yes. Yes, exactly.
Which I love to read. I love to read those books. I don't necessarily want to be the protagonist.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
We mentioned before we switched on the microphones that congratulations on this. Your book has been nominated for the Management Book of the Year prize.
Yes. Thrillingly. Let's talk about it before the awards ceremony, just to get the pleasure in there.
But what does that mean? Because you know, we can be general readers and enjoy this book.
Yes.
But obviously this has been put into a category by your publishers and stuff as well. Does that, I wouldn't say that sort of pigeonholes the book unnecessarily, but you and your publishers obviously notice a desire in terms of big business and companies and people that manage people, that this is something that needs to be fixed or addressed or talked about within the workplace. Do you go and talk to people on this subject? Are you called in by large firms?
I feel like a politician that's on a permanent campaign. I've done over 100 talks and interviews since the hardback. In fact, it's running straight through.
I thought you were good at this.
But I mean, I think what's wonderful about it is we all live lives that I would describe as the blended self. We're all living lives where we're at work and doing work, but we're a stone's throw away from picking up the mobile to do something domestic, if you like. In fact, I've just joined the board of the European Workforce Institute, run by an interesting capital management software company, where they're dealing a lot with workers on the shop floor. And we're looking together at the implications for interrupted work patterns, where even if you are in a factory setting, of course, you're permanently connected to your life through your device. Somebody can text you or you can look up Facebook. So these present real challenges. But I am also writing for the manager. I much prefer, by the way, the term manager to leader. I think, you know, talk of leadership is much more overrated. I much prefer the process-driven, practical manager, which is...
It's a bit idolatrous leader, isn't it?
Well,
I'm getting a bit Mao-ish and things, you know.
I just think that change is quite granular, and I think the talk about leadership is quite grandiose, but that's a sort of little bugbear of mine. So for me, the way...
I'd change my business cards then.
Yes, don't put leader on your business card, for God's sake. What is interesting to me is that I think the way now we think about a productive, satisfied, creative organisation, it should be quite similar to the way we think about a productive, happy, creative individual, because in a sense we have the same issues, which is we are people having to do things, some of which we like, some of which we don't like, with other people. And so again, connectedness has got to be seen both in the context, it seems to me, of the hardware, the infrastructure, the technology. Here we are in front of microphones in part of a heavily networked radio studio. But it's also...
At least on the
outside.
That's
the theory. but it's also the software side. The software is the relationships, the patchwork, the networks. So I think it is an exciting time. I think it absolutely is important that business people read and think about management in a connected age. But I just don't think any of us can dodge the bullet as individuals. And I love it when people come up to me at festivals and talks as individuals, if you like, not as managers. And so fingers crossed I can achieve both with this piece of work.
And what about inspiration that you find, Julie? Obviously, you know, I'm sure you read very widely around this. You're constantly talking to people and with people. Is it a question of going to markets where they seem to have aspects, at least facets of this, right? You know, people talk about, oh, the work-life balance, or going to the Scandinavian model, or, you know, why do the French work so many fewer hours than we work, and yet we're all as unproductive as each other?
Yeah.
Where do you find the most consistent platforms for garnering fresh and useful insights in terms of what you do day to day?
It's a great question. I do read a lot. I do read a lot of current thinking, but funnily enough, I do read some straight management and business books. I'm quite interested in books about mindfulness in business, that sort of switching off, and in fact sort of in praise of mindlessness, really, you know, this idea that we stuff ourselves constantly full of things. But I also am very interested in a range of thinking coming out of corporations who are designing workspaces and workplaces differently. There's quite an interesting trend happening around workspaces, which is big retail business, and you're finding a lot of large companies are now putting in little incubators and accelerator offshoots into these new spaces. So for me, the design of where and how we work is really, really quite an interesting space.
When you say these incubation spaces and things within a large, are these offices? Are these just what we would have called sort of corner offices?
No.
Do they share the dimensions?
Talking about these sort of, I mean, effectively privatised versions of what happens in coffee shops,
okay,
where everyone's at their laptop. Yeah. But these are now becoming a bit more organised to be community spaces. So, for example, in London, the very famous Peckham car park that's being turned into a community space. I'm told that you have to effectively pay a community activity rent in order to have a space, and that involves you collaborating and connecting with other people. That's an interesting development. But back to your point, Tom, you know, we are on the nursery slopes here in this thinking. Mm. One of the things I'm planning is some research to actually evidence-base the engagement and productivity around how people manage what I call the knot of social health, which is an acronym for knowledge, networks and time. These are the very DNA processes of how we work and live in exactly the same way that with our health, we say, I don't know, diet, sleep, exercise are the sort of DNA elements of good fitness and health. So we are right at the beginning of this. Ask me back in a year and I'd love to be able to give you a list of 10 global corporations that have what I call social health. None have it consistently at the moment.
It's agreed. 12 months from now, let's do it. I just wondered, a bit like, it's funny, you talk about individual physical health and mental well-being, and there's a tendency, I guess, to sometimes throw the baby out with the bathwater, particularly dry January. People say, right, that's it. Not only am I going to cut down on trans fats, but I'm not going to have anything, and you end up doing more damage than a more measured approach. Does that happen a little bit in terms of working practices? People say, right, that's it. I'm going to make like the Unabomber that I was talking to Rob about earlier and go and hide away in a shack in the woods and devote my life to saying technology will destroy mankind. Whereas actually it's baby steps. It's small
Absolutely.
Adjustments that
I mean,
really
diets
important.
Don't work, do they? So any kind of enforced stricture that's unsustainable is a bit of a bore and a bit of a sort of look at me. I am kind of interested in the neuroscience of motivation, that I'm a buyer of the view, contested, of course, everything in the sciences, there's an alternative view. But I do believe willpower is finite and motivation is finite. There's some very interesting research that came out of course, California on this. And what that means essentially is you really want to kind of lighten the cognitive load if you're going to change your behaviours. You want something that isn't prefaced by I must or I should, but no, this works for me. I can make this switch. And that seems to me a very healthy, no pun intended, development right across the society now, that we're moving less to analytical theory-based changes and more to cognitive-based. Can I put one foot in front of the other and make a difference? Can I walk a little bit more? Can I do whatever? And I think social health is about how do we make it work for us? And what works for me, you know, a 53-year-old British woman entrepreneur is going to be by necessity quite different to someone of a different age or gender or possibly living in a different continent.
You talk about it so well, Julia. It's fascinating stuff. I mean, I remember my first job. My first job was my first ever email account just over 20 years ago. And I can't believe now we are talking very seriously, and there are, you know, wonderful books on the subject such as yours about how to wean ourselves off, how to manage this stuff. It's happened so quickly. Very timely. It's Fully Connected. It's by Julia Hobsbawm. Thank you very much indeed. And it is out now. You're tuned in to the Monocle Weekly. ...455 editions of the Monocle Weekly down. How do you think that programme went, Tom? I enjoyed it thoroughly.
I thought that was absolutely first class, Rob. And I was delighted with all of our guests.
Yeah?
And I feel better positioned to manage the digital white noise of day-to-day life.
Do we not also love the man that is Travis Elbra?
Great guy. I could talk to him all day.
Do you know what I mean? Anyway, thank you to all our guests. Thank you, of course, also to our team. Today's show was produced by Tom Hall, researched by James Kitchen, and our studio managers were Cassie Galpin and Tommy Horner. The Monocle Weekly will be back same time, same place next week. For the time being, from me, Robert Bound.
And from me, Tom Edwards.
Thanks for tuning in.